You think of women like Marlo Thomas, Mary Tyler Moore, and Lucille Ball as paving the way in the television industry. And then we think of people like Murphy Brown and Diane English and Roseanne Barr for bringing flawed but real women to the television. Now, we have bold-faced names like Shonda Rhimes, Issa Rae, and Tina Fey, and they're depicting the female experience as difficult without labeling women as difficult. And generally, they're broadening the range of stories that get told. Opportunities for women in television have steadily expanded over the years, but where are we now? Are women being offered dynamic leading roles? Are scripts being written by women, for women, directed and produced by women? Author Joy Press is here to talk about all of this. Her book, Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television, is published by Atria Books. Joy's been writing about television for more than 15 years. She was the chief TV critic at The Village Voice and the books and culture editor at the Los Angeles Times. I spoke with Joy Press in March, and we're rebroadcasting that interview for you now. So you called 2015 in particular a triumphant moment for television created by women. What happened in 2015?
Well, 2015 was a moment when there were a small deluge of shows created by women that were sort of female-centric, had very central female characters. You had shows like Transparent and Orange is the New Black and Inside Amy Schumer that were really getting celebrated and getting awards and, you know, girls. All of these shows had become very visible, and it was a moment when it felt like things were really changing in terms of both women's power on television behind the scenes and in terms of the range of female characters and portrayals. And really, since then, it's actually exponentially expanded. I mean, there just has been a kind of nonstop flow of like really creative experimental shows by women.
What was that surge in 2015 about? Did that just something happened in the time-space continuum, or why did that start to happen?
Well, I think some of it is a trend. I mean, you see every so often, you know, people jump on board and around kind of 2011, 2012, you had Lena Dunham, you had Mindy Kaling, you had New Girl, a whole spate of shows that really caught people's imagination. But I think you also had a real change in the television industry. Mm. A lot of the current crop of shows sort of came via streaming. Netflix, you know, brought in, did really, really well with Orange is the New Black. I mean, it really kind of helped to make their name, and, you know, people were just gobbling it up. And Amazon certainly did very well with Transparent. I think it gave them a lot of cultural credibility.
Mm-hmm. Just the fact of those successes.
Those successes, and just also there's so many platforms. And so traditionally, women tend to get opportunities on channels, networks that are not doing as well, on networks that need, you know, more content. So there were just a lot more openings, and there were a lot of places that were willing to take a chance on women, because apparently women are very risky.
Quote unquote, take a chance, right?
It's a niche. Women are a niche.
Yeah, right. So in your book, you could have started in all kinds of places. You know, you mentioned the women I talked about, Lucille Ball and Marlo Thomas and Mary Tyler Moore in the introduction. But you start with Diane English and Murphy Brown. Why did you begin there?
Well, when I started it, it felt like Murphy Brown and Roseanne, those two shows, premiered within a month of each other in 1988. And it was really fascinating to me to go back historically and look at that moment. It felt like the kind of the start of the modern moment. And those two characters felt like the beginning of our current wave of, you know, fairly assertive, fierce, funny, and, you know, sometimes problematic, borderline obnoxious. You know, they kind of opened up a lot of ground. And you know, just culturally looking at those two shows, it was a moment that kind of came to be defined as the culture wars. And
it's 1988
late 80s, early 90s, very polarized, you know, red state, blue state. Very familiar now, you know, not that far off from the current moment. The religious right was in the ascendant. There were lots of attacks on sort of women's reproductive rights and gay rights. And these two shows were absolutely at the center of the culture. You know, I mean, aside from the fact that 20 to 30 million people were watching these shows, which is an unthinkable amount of people now,
right.
You know, everyone was paying attention and they became very symbolic of a certain kind of culture. And in Murphy Brown's case, the vice president of the United States decided to demonize this, you know, single working mother. I mean, she was a working woman who decided to have a baby on her own, and he made it the center of Bush Senior's, you know, reelection campaign, and started this idea of the Hollywood elite. And so it was fascinating to look back both at how trailblazing these characters were, how hard it was for the women who created them behind the scenes, and how much they sort of set the stage for some of the
and created
stuff we
the
see
culture
now.
In. Yeah, I mean, this to remind folks, the storyline was that Murphy Brown decided she was going to have a baby without being married, and that set ablaze the religious right. And you write that Diane English was surprised by the response to that.
Yeah, she says she was surprised. I mean, I think there were certain things that they did. You know, the father of the baby was Murphy's ex. I think she was very briefly married to someone. I think they probably got, you know, like an AIDS test. I mean, they did, you know, some of the right things. But there were plenty of single mothers around. And, you know, I think this happened in 1991, 1992. So, you know, she was really startled. And it was something that, you know, I think Quayle and Bush just decided it played to their base. Mm. And they, you know, it was a family values issue. And, you know, they demonized her. And of course, the show itself decided to take the other side. And they, you know, in the fictional show, Murphy Brown was addressing the president and their, you know, their right. policies towards women. So right. it became, you know, both sides kind of arguing ideas that were central to the culture.
It's sort of a remarkable moment in TV history. I mean, had something like that happened before, where you had sort of a fictional character arguing with the candidates for president?
I don't think that really had ever happened, and really hasn't happened since. And, you know, I think Diane English, you know, they won awards, and she got up at, you know, at the Emmys and sort of addressed it as well. And so everybody, I think, got very invested in this character who represented a pretty, you know, substantial strand of American women.
But the network hadn't always been supportive of the idea, right? I mean, they did, is it that they didn't like Candace Bergen? Did I get that correct?
No, you know, initially, I think traditionally on television, and this has really lasted up until recently, you know, there were very narrow definitions of what a woman should be like on television, and certainly a lead character. And, you know, they wanted her to be a younger actress. I think at one point Heather Locklear was mentioned, who was the
It's hard to imagine Heather Locklear as Murphy Brown.
Yeah, I mean, she was a sexy, nubile, you know, 30-year-old. They didn't want a 40-something. And Murphy Brown, as written originally, was coming back from rehab. She had drinking problems. She was a tough woman, and they wanted her to have been returning from a spa. but Diane English actually won the battle because there was a writer's strike. And so the changes that they would have wanted her to make couldn't happen until after the strike. And so they decided to go with the script as it was written. And, you know, we got Murphy as we know her.
So once again, when there's sort of some crisis in the industry is when women are given an opportunity or can take an opportunity, I guess.
They slip through the cracks. Absolutely.
Right. I'm Kai Wright. I'm speaking with Joy Press about our book, Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. We're back with a conversation I had in March with Joy Press, the author of Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television, published by Atria Books. When we returned from the break, I asked Joy what made the original Roseanne series different from other sitcoms when it premiered in 1988.
Well, I mean, Roseanne was almost the complete opposite to Murphy Brown. Murphy was this very elite, powerful woman in Washington, D.C. And Roseanne, the character, and Roseanne, the woman, you know, it was a woman who was poor, very hardworking, mother of a big family, trying to keep them afloat. She was unglamorous. You know, she was much larger than your usual female heroine, and she was louder. She was shrill. I mean, she had this amazing laugh.
Unapologetically,
you know, and she had come from that background very recently. She had just recently been a poor housewife, you know, with children in Colorado, you know, doing stand-up at, like, feminist bookstores and local bars. And she brought this sensibility, this outsider sensibility, into the show. And backstage, behind the scenes, was a very crazy situation, because she was fighting for this vision, and she wasn't politic, and she wasn't, you know, inside the system, but she knew what she wanted. She wanted to have this very real family on the television screen. And it was really, there had been other working class families on TV, you know, you'd had the Honeymooners and All in the Family. But this was really different. And this was a kind of woman who had no apologies and was loud and brash, but she was also incredibly funny. Yeah. And she brought everybody with her.
And she was, it sounds like you're describing, she was difficult, right? I mean, you have a quote in the book from Norma Safford Vela. Is that how you pronounce her name? Who was one of the writers on Roseanne. She says, the history of women in television is if women are difficult, they don't work again.
Yeah. And, you know, Roseanne had one of the most successful shows ever. That show was, you know, number one for years. It was in the top 10. But she was difficult, and she had a really hard time figuring out how to transition after Roseanne. I mean, it was on for a decade and then really disappeared kind of until now. And I think it is very tough, because being a showrunner, being in charge of a show, you have to be difficult in some ways. I think you have to be very much prepared to fight for everything. Television is an enormously collaborative art form, and I think it's much easier for men to find a space in which to fight. It is not necessarily seen as being difficult. It is seen as being strong.
Just quickly, so people understand, a showrunner is, what is a showrunner?
So a showrunner is sort of what it sounds like. I mean, it's the person who kind of is in charge of the show, and traditionally it is someone who's a writer. Which is not really where Roseanne came from, but almost everyone else on my in the book that I talk about, it's the person who is in charge of the writing, either writes it, is the head writer, oversees the writers, but also chooses the actors, chooses the directors, and, you know, interacts with all of the sort of network executives, is dealing with the budget. So
it's really kind of the guardian of the vision.
It's the guardian, and usually it's the creator. So it's the guardian of the vision, and it's an crazy job. It's often sort of part done in partnership, because it's very hard to do for one person. And, you know, writers aren't necessarily good managers. That's not, you know, we tend to sit at home, you know, with our computers. So it's hard to find somebody who has all of those things and can do them well, and also can be polite about it,
But also, as you point out, I mean, even if aside from being polite, it's a job that doesn't really reward politeness.
Right.
And, you know, if you're doing something new and different, you're pushing a boulder uphill always when you do something creative and new. And so I imagine this idea of difficult women in this, it's sort of a catch-22. You can't succeed at the job without being difficult.
I think you can't. I think, you know, some people are more tactful than others. But I think it's something that all, you know, a lot of women can relate to. I mean, just in the workplace in general, you know, you end up having to find a space in which you can demand what needs to be done and yet not offend or threaten, you know, some of your fellow coworkers, and particularly men. So this was a really big issue in Hollywood, and women really did get branded as difficult. It was true for female directors in Hollywood too. I mean, where, you know, and actresses, we hear an awful lot these days about, you know, some actresses who disappeared because they were termed difficult, and I think now we're all starting to question why.
Which is something that never comes up for men.
Never comes up. At all. And Lord knows there are many, many men in Hollywood who are very, very difficult.
And in the world, indeed.
And in the world.
Probably myself included. We have to sort of talk about also with Roseanne her current controversy, which is kind of ironic or interesting. Maybe it's not, but, you know, she's this feminist icon on one hand, but has been a very vocal supporter of Donald Trump, and that has alienated a lot of her fans. How do you think about that?
It was a little bit surprising to me because when I went back, I actually have a quote in the book. I found an interview from sort of, you know, early on in Roseanne, probably right around the time that the Murphy Brown Dan Quayle controversy was happening. Roseanne Barr said, you know, we don't deal with politics directly in the show. And the show was very political in very subtle ways. I mean, they wove it organically into the show. So they had episodes about, you know, gay marriage. They had episodes about contraception, which was a big issue then. But, you know, they never came out and supported the Connor family, didn't support any political candidate. And, you know, at the time, Roseanne said, yeah, we don't do that because our people, you know, the people who are like the Connors don't trust either side. Mm. They're just trying to get by. And so it was really interesting that in this, you know, reboot that they would choose to side with the Trump. I mean, I actually think it could be very interesting dramatically. I haven't seen it. I think they could do really interesting things with the family being Trump supporters. I mean, you know, it is hopefully still really grounded in reality, and you know, the town that they're in is probably really suffering, and so that could be interesting.
I think she said that's her point, is that this is that the Connors would be Trump supporters in real life, but I mean, it's notable she herself, Roseanne Barr, has been quite a vocal Trump supporter.
Well, Roseanne never does anything that anyone expects her to.
Yep.
So in a way, that surprising fact doesn't surprise me.
Right. So what about Shonda Rhimes and her impact in all of this? She has, you know, I guess we could argue, has been probably in the modern times and one of the most revolutionary people in terms of creating space for women. What has been her impact on this?
Shonda Rhimes is really a remarkable figure. And, you know, I think on the business side, she gets credit because she is one of the most powerful, not just women, she's one of the most powerful producers and writers in Hollywood. I think that in terms of creativity, you know, she often gets brushed aside a little bit. And I think a lot of the time these female creators, because they're not necessarily creating, you know, these opuses about male angst and and murder and, you know, sort of get brushed aside. It's a soap opera or it's a romance. And, you know, I think Shonda has very sneakily kind of created all kinds of innovative roles for women, for people of color, has very quietly invaded these genres that are kind of disrespected or ignored, and done all kinds of interesting things with them, and also been insanely popular, you know. And so she's created. People are talking now about inclusion writers and how do we? I mean, Shonda, you know, never needed an inclusion writer.
She did something called colorblind casting, right? With Grey's Anatomy. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, in general, her mode of operation with her shows is that they don't assume that a white person is the default, you know? And so when they create a character, sort of the casting agent talked about just sort of leaving an open space. So they bring in a whole lot of people and they kind of see who's the best person. And then gradually the writers will sort of customize that part. Now, certainly early on in Grey's Anatomy, the characters didn't actually necessarily have very specific kind of racial characteristics or you know, a specific cultural background. It was a little bit idealized, you know. It was like the hospital was this idealized place where there was no discrimination against women or people of color and everything. Everybody was just, you know, if you were good at what you did, you were rewarded, which, you know, is sort of how we would all like the world to be. Right. And, you know, gradually, I think, has sort of introduced more, you know, kind of political and cultural elements into her shows. But it created a world that was as absolutely inclusive and diverse as any show on television.
Well, and you talked about the 2015 sort of boom of starting to have shows that had these strong and central women characters. And I feel like, it feels to me like there's been another boom of shows specifically around women of color and mm-hmm. black women in particular. I wonder, you know, I'm thinking of Issa Rae and, you know, even Black-ish with, you know, the characters there. It's
Queen Sugar
and Ava DuVernay's career in general, you know. How much is that about Shonda Rhimes, do you think? How much did she kind of create that space?
You know, I don't know that anybody credits her with that directly, but I think there's no doubt that Hollywood is about money, and that seeing that shows with, you know, African-American women at the front of them can do well. People will watch them. People are excited to watch them. That has to have an impact. And I think it's both inspiring to creators and it is encouraging to the people who have the wallets to say, oh, you know, this is an actual audience. We should think about serving it. I mean, I'm not sure why it took so long, but.
Well, we can imagine why it took so long. While we're saying all of this good news, though, you know, I mean, we do have to acknowledge how much is left to be done. I mean, I'm thinking of there was a study from the Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film of the 2016 and 2017 season that said there were 1 in 5 broadcast TV creators was female. And on cable outlets, it was just slightly better at 1 in 4. Are those sobering numbers within all of this, or how do we think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because anecdotally, it feels like things are improving. And I see enormous numbers of female writers who are getting opportunities and starting to sort of move their way up the ladder. But statistically, it's still really stuck. And in fact, I actually called the woman who does that study when I was finishing my book to say, you know, I want to, can you tell me what next year's numbers are looking like? Because it must be better. And she said, no, it's really pretty static. I don't think it's going to be much better. But I think they're improving very, very slowly. And I actually think that, you know, the sort of Me Too conversation has caused people to think about the structural problems and not just sort of go, oh, there are plenty of women out there. Yeah. There are plenty of women making TV. So I do think that there's going to be a change, but it's very incremental.
Do you get a sense that, I mean, from following this, that there are some projects that are being greenlit that weren't, or opportunities that are happening as a consequence of the last several months of conversation?
I'm seeing that definitely. I think that the you know, executives want to react. You know, they feel it, what's happening in the air, and they want to react to it. I know that I saw a number of pilots, and pilots are things that, like, it's the first episode of a show that, you know, a network will decide whether they're going to, you know, give a full order to a show and let a season go on the air. And there were a lot of pilots this year created by women or with sort of very female-centric focus. Whether those shows get made into series is going to be the test. A very large number had, you know, sort of women behind them. And so my hope is that we will see a change. And certainly, you know, with all of the sort of streaming networks and cable networks competing for content, there's likely to be more opportunity.
And they can get content up more quickly, correct? Is that, am I understanding that right?
Yes, absolutely.
So they could presumably respond to this moment in a way that networks might take longer to do.
One hopes. I mean, I think the audience is hungry for it.
Yeah. I'm Kai Wright. I've been speaking with Joy Press about her book, Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.